This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to The Commercial Investing Show, where we analyze, explain, and exploit the opportunities presented in today's commercial property marketplace. If you're interested in apartments, mobile home parks, self-storage facilities, and other income property, you've come to the right place. We'll explore what's hot and what's not in markets nationwide in the relentless pursuit of return on investment. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to the Commercial Investing Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we discuss the relentless pursuit of ROI. Yes, that's right, return on investment and return on inflation. We have a changing future with monetary policy and fiscal policy the way it is, and we need to prepare for it as investors by structuring our transactions differently, and we will talk about that on this episode and future episodes, of course. So we will be back with a fantastic interview for you and a guest today in just less than 60 seconds. Stay tuned.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn how to finance your next big real estate deal, there's a show for that. If you want to learn more about food storage and the best way to keep those onions from smelling up everything else, there's a show for that. If you honestly want to know more about business ethics, there's a show for that. And if you just want to get away from it all and need to know something about world travel, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com. Or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
It's my pleasure to welcome one of our clients back to the show. He was actually on a long time ago. I think it was maybe, 5 or 6 years ago when he started investing with us. And his name is David Porter, and it's a pleasure to have him join us today. Dave, welcome. How are you?
Great, Jason. It's great to be back with you. And I think it was probably a good 5 years ago when I last joined you on a podcast.
And I remember that day all too well. I remember that I was rather stressed out sitting in my office, and your investment counselor, Sarah, kind of came into my door with you, and I was thinking, like, please don't bother me. I'm so busy right now. and then Sarah said, Jason, you got to hear his story. This is David Porter, our client, and you just got to hear his story. And it was a really cool story.
Of
I think your first investment property that you got from us in Indianapolis, right?
Right. Well, you know, it's so funny. You know, since, Jason, when you think when we first met, the economy was crashing, right? It was 2008.
Oh, yeah.
So some of these foreclosure opportunities were developing. And, I purchased my first property through you guys in Indiana.
Good stuff. And then you started buying up Indianapolis. You were kind of like quite the real estate mogul there. And I don't really know what you've done all these years. I know Sarah's been in touch with you, but I haven't specifically. I hear about you once in a while. But, you know, tell us how it all went and what you've been doing and so forth.
Yeah, for sure. So, let's see. We got started. I just looked at some records before we got to talking here. We started talking late 2008. I purchased my first property in Indianapolis in March of 2009. Mm-hmm. And that was an unbelievable, and you think about it now because prices have gone up a lot since then, but for $85,000 in that foreclosure market, we picked up a 3,000 square foot, 5-year-old home in a suburban, very, very nice neighborhood, right? And it's incredible. That property today is running out for like $1,250, right?
So, that's fantastic. So one of the things that I was talking about on the podcast way back then, and, you know, I've talked about it many, many times since then. I'm probably boring my listeners saying the same stuff over and over, but it was the concept of buying below construction cost.
Exactly.
And it was also the concept I've talked about a lot that I call regression to replacement cost. Mm-hmm. And you have a background in financial services and then in the transportation business, shipping and trucking. banking companies and so forth. And by the way, I want to ask you some insights, because those are really interesting barometers about the economy.
Sure.
And global and national trade and so forth. So maybe we'll get to that. But you bought this house. I thought you paid like $89,000 for that house, and it appraised, or your insurance company, I think it was your insurance company told you you had to insure it for like, what, $240,000 or something?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. Oh, wow. Your memory is very, very good. Those numbers are almost spot on. And that was the story repeatedly, because I bought after that 8 more properties in Indianapolis. And when you think about it, at first I was, okay, the insurance company's made a mistake, you know, they're trying to charge me too much and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it kind of makes sense when you think about it, because to rebuild and go out and buy all the lumber and steel and recreate a 3,000 square foot house is going to cost you a couple hundred thousand dollars. It doesn't matter what you paid for it. So that's kind of their thinking, and that's what I had to do. I mean, I shopped it around.
Yeah, wow. And so you bought the house for $85,000 or $89,000.
Yeah,
$85,000. Okay, and the insurance company told you you had to insure it for $240,000. Is that my number?
That's real close. Yeah. I don't remember the exact number, but it was like $240,000, $250,000, something like that.
Yeah. So at first that probably upset you. Right. You know, you're thinking, why do I have to pay insurance on such a large amount when I only paid $85,000 for the house? But the insurance company was thinking, if that house burns down, that's what it's going to cost us to rebuild it, right?
Right. Well, as mad as I was, the only thing that would have been worse if they would say, no, we're only going to insure it for $50,000 because you overpaid for the house.
Yeah, that wouldn't have been good. That wouldn't have been good.
No. Yeah, so, but the way you put that, you know, was really a great way for me to think about it. And, you know, there was blood in the streets at that time, right? I mean, again, the economy was falling apart. People were very concerned about what was going to happen. You know, I'm telling my friends, hey, I'm buying these houses in Indiana. So I'm here in California. And they're like, okay, Dave, you're buying houses in Indiana. That's really strange. How, you know, and so
they probably thought you were crazy, right?
They thought I was crazy. Absolutely. And, you know, I didn't know, of course, at the time that we were buying these homes over the course of the next really 3 years. You never know if you're buying at the bottom or really where you're at. But I had a lot of I'm a very conservative investor. I don't like a lot of debt. And I felt it was a very conservative investment because based on what I knew the rents were and the rental market was relatively strong despite everything else, because everybody was losing their homes. And the rental market is still a great place to be. Even if it went down 10% or whatever, I mean, how much lower could it go, given the fact that I've got this plot of land in a nice suburban area and relatively new construction and good size, right? How much lower could it go? It couldn't go to nothing like a stock, right?
Yeah, I agree with you. And even if it did, you're still really, I mean, a prudent cash flow investor.
Right.
So cash flow is the name of the game. If you get the capital appreciation, hey, you know, I'll take it, you'll take it, that's the icing on the cake. But you know, either way, cash flow is a pretty reliable thing. I mean, it's not perfect. It does change, but
right. It
doesn't fluctuate a lot. You know, these investors that are, well, they call themselves investors. I call them gamblers, but, you know, who invest in these high price markets, just waiting for something incredible to happen. I don't know. I think they're in trouble. You know,
That's speculation, right? And you know, one of the biggest regrets I have in my real estate career is like the first house I bought to live in. California went through one of its down markets, and I sold it at a loss and wrote a check to leave. And I wish I would have just held on to it. I'm sure you've heard that a million times. But other than that, I've never sold a property. You know, I think that, you know, there's only so much real estate. They're not making new real estate. And if you have a property in a solid area, that's a great long-term investment. And you talk about cash flow. So my whole strategy around this is really to create a nice income stream, a nice passive income stream to take me eventually into retirement.
Absolutely. Well, I think you're doing a great job at that. So tell the listeners, if you would, Dave, how many properties did you end up buying in Indianapolis, or, you know, the greater metro area of Indianapolis?
Right. So bought 9 altogether in the greater Indianapolis area.
Yeah. And what gave you, you know, you saw the blood in the streets. I mean, back then you were in the shipping business. So, you know, you were in the container shipping business, as I recall. And that was experiencing a downturn. I mean, global trade was suffering. I used to read articles, and I remember asking you about this, about how, you know, there were just empty shipping containers everywhere.
Yep.
And, you know, it wasn't even wise to run these big freighter ships because, you know, there was just so little trade. I mean, it was a scary time. What gave you the confidence to invest back then?
You know, it was really, it was the best place to go, I felt, at the time with your money. So I had a career in shipping for about 20 years at that point. And so you'll learn here, I'm not a very good market timer. In 2007, I left the transportation business to go into financial consulting, you know, for investors. We're putting together portfolios of stocks, basically mutual funds for high net worth investors. And at the time I heard your commercial, I mean, things were just falling through the floor, you know, Lehman Brothers, everything was happening at that particular time. And I was just kind of curious, there must be another way, you know. And when I thought about, I learned about the approach, and when I saw, again, you know, these assets that in some overbuilt markets that had taken just such a hit, but the rents had stayed solid. And my goal was rents. My goal was the cash flow. If my welfare would be independent of the value of the underlying asset, really, as long as the rents held up. And I really liked that idea, because if you think about a stock portfolio, a mutual fund portfolio, you know, the rule of thumb for advising clients for retirement is you can take out about 4% of your portfolio per year, and that'll last you, you know, well into your retirement, perhaps even, you know, the 30 and 40 years, things like that. They've run a lot of back testing. There's no guarantees with that, but that's kind of safe. So when I looked at the kind of income I was going to generate with a portfolio of houses, I would need much more money invested in mutual funds to generate that equal amount of income. So that's the way I looked at it. What would I have to invest in order to generate a certain amount of passive income? And the real estate was clearly the winner at the time. It was just kind of fact-based, and I'd seen the market was so beaten up, I didn't see a big downside even on the value of the asset itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you. Well, when you were buying the properties in Indianapolis, and I know you did some other stuff too, which maybe we can get to.
Sure.
But when you were buying those, were you paying cash for them, or were you getting financing on them? I can't remember. I think you may have mentioned it on the show. Sure. We did a few years back, but
well, it was a combination of the two. And at the time I went into this, Jason, I had zero debt in my life. Zero debt. And honestly,
and you met me and you got into debt, right?
You corrupted me.
I have done my job.
Yes, but I'm still conservative. My cash flow has paid off several of these properties. But what I did is I just had some other property that was owned outright. And basically, if you were credit worthy at the time, you know, they were throwing money at you at very low interest rates, right? Historically low. So I did take out a loan, and I'm paying on it still today. It's 3.49% fixed interest for 30 years.
Oh, my gosh. You know, until recently, Dave, you have been getting paid to borrow that money for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say, and I have to admit, as much as I don't like admitting this or even having it be this way, that inflation is actually pretty darn low the last year now. It was definitely higher in the last few years, but it's calmed down. I'm really surprised. And I don't, do you listen to the podcast regularly?
Not regularly, but sporadically. I've listened to a couple dozen of them over the years, though. I haven't heard any recent ones.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I'm just surprised inflation isn't higher. I'm surprised interest rates aren't higher.
I am too.
I think that inflation is coming back, though. I will tell you that. I don't think we're going to see it low for very long.
it's not going to last forever. You know, I did hear you interviewed Richard Duncan.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one of my favorite. He's my favorite economist. And even he, as bright as he is, and he does this full time, you know, are we going to die a death of icy deflation or hyperinflation, right? I mean, it's hard to tell, and neither one of those scenarios is very good, but clearly what we're doing isn't sustainable. So, you know, I don't know.
Who the heck knows? I mean, it would be sort of possible to really predict economic scenarios with some accuracy if it wasn't for central bank and government intervention.
Yeah.
I mean, you just never know what they're going to do. You know, you can, they just interfere with the markets and they pervert the whole thing. So you just can't predict stuff very well because of them. I mean, you can think, what would they logically do? And you can sort of predict that, but it's still, you know, it's difficult.
I don't think we're operating in a logical world right now. And Richard Duncan puts it real well. And I think he said on your podcast, and this is really what broke my heart when I was in the financial services industry. I was with a very good firm. They were thinking about things that they weren't speculating in stocks or penny stocks or any of that kind of thing. It was a pretty conservative approach. But, you know, people would like to think that they're investing in capitalism. But they're not investing in capitalism. And as Richard Duncan says so well, it's statism. And that's to your point. What's the government going to decide to do with the banking system? What's the reserve requirement? What are they going to do with interest rates? All these things throw stocks for a loop. And it's what you're taught in school. And I have an MBA. I'm a finance major. And that's my training. They tell you that you evaluate stocks by the value of the earnings of the company. Well, I wish that was the case. It's not the case. That's part of the equation. It's
by the story, right?
Yeah. It's the story, and it's what the government decides they're going to do with their policy and how that's going to impact a particular industry.
Yeah, that's just ridiculous.
And there's no way to factor that into a spreadsheet.
Right.
I mean,
I agree with you. So what exactly was your background in financial services? I mean, were you an advisor? Did you work with clients and help them invest their money?
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was a registered investment advisor. And so we dealt with high net worth clients, and we put together portfolios of index funds. So within the world of investing, that's a pretty conservative, reasonable, well-diversified way to go. We had all types of portfolios that would be in alignment with somebody's age and risk tolerance, basically.
Ladies and gentlemen, what we have here is a defector.
I still have a foot in a camp, and
I'm glad you came over to the other side.
Yeah, and I am too. And so, you know, going back to, you know, my investing in real estate story, what I came to realize, largely with your help, and I can honestly say if I hadn't, attended some of your sessions and had some of the conversations and read some of your material, I wouldn't have thought about it this way. But, you know, having untapped ability to borrow, having that ability to borrow and not utilizing it is kind of like, you know, sticking money under your mattress and maybe it's even worse than that because you don't even get the money. So what I did is, you know, I took that ability to borrow and I put it to work in a very, very, very conservative way. And it was clear to me that my income stream would, you know, more than pay for any debt service that I would have. In addition, you get all the benefits of, what our tax code allows us to do with those interest payments. So it really it helped me a great deal. So I don't borrow as much as I could borrow, and I'm comfortable with where I'm at. I'm still in a very conservative position. But so what I did is I took some money out of property holdings I had and paid cash for a number of properties in Indiana.
Mm-hmm. And so you didn't really completely follow my plan. I mean, I would have said lever
right.
everything up,
yep.
you know,
I know.
because it's kind of counterintuitive, you know, like I think the more conservative position is actually to be the borrower. You know, and I know that goes against the grain of what a lot of people think. I completely get it. You know, I used to in the old days think pay everything off. And I remember having this conversation with a friend of mine. We were on the board of a cancer charity in Orange County, California, where I used to live. And her name is Catherine. And I remember that, you know, her parents were, had some financial hardship. And I remember, you know, thinking, gosh, they were losing their house. They had this gorgeous home in Mission Viejo area. And they were going into foreclosure. And I remember thinking that, you know, the thing to do is to just pay off your own home. So at least you own that. And, you know, all the other investments could be leveraged and you might lose them, but you'll never lose your house, right? But the reality is, you know, we have a perpetual lien on all our properties called property taxes. And in some cases, maybe a second lien called a homeowners association. And, you know, those agencies or their investors, because people buy tax liens as a tradable asset, you know, they look at those in a predatory fashion. If you've got a lot of equity, you're a target, you know. So I don't like having big equity in real estate, even though, you know, I do own some properties with equity. But if I could lever them more, believe me, I would.
So you've taken, I'm kind of in between where I was and where you are now. But
I've moved the needle a little bit.
You've moved a lot, really, you know. So it's worked out well. So, and then also with Platinum's help, I went into Arizona. Mm-hmm. And so that's a different market, right?
Yeah,
and you
yeah.
told me at the time that I went into Indiana, he said, Dave, you were cautioning me. He said, you need to get more diversified. You've got too much in Indiana.
Right.
And so you said, Indiana's like a bond. You know, you shouldn't expect a lot of appreciation there, but it seems like the rents are pretty stable. And so it's good for that if that's what you want to have. And that is clearly what I was looking for, right? The income, the stable long-term income. But, you know, the Phoenix market, as you well know, and you've taken good advantage of, got beat down awfully hard. And I think the dynamics of that market are that, you know, you've got the weather there and a growing economy, and it attracts people. And if you look at the demographics of North America, I knew that people were going to be coming back to Phoenix again. And so we bought a couple of properties in suburban Phoenix, Gilbert. And those have worked out extremely well. So not only from a thing I love about Phoenix or Arizona is property taxes are low, the insurance is low, and I did get some really nice appreciation on those properties as well.
Yeah, you know, Phoenix is a very desirable city. It's now that I've lived here for a little over 3 years, you know, it's kind of a gem. A lot of people don't know about it. People from California that live in Orange County, where I used to live, and LA, where I grew up as a kid, they think I'm nuts, you know, but I ask them, like, when's the last time you were actually here? You know, this is a really nice place. We've got super swanky restaurants and, you know, all kinds of nice things here. It's, you know, other than 3 or 4 months when it's hot, but it's a dry heat,
right.
You know, it's a pretty nice place. Although right now it doesn't make sense from an investment standpoint. It's just too expensive. It's a hybrid market. You know, it's not like Indianapolis is a linear, virtually the whole state of California. And you're in Southern California, right?
That's right.
Yeah. You know, that's a cyclical market. So Phoenix is in between the two. But right now, you know, we've moved in and out of Phoenix a couple of times, and sometimes it just gets overvalued, and or at least maybe I don't even want to call it overvalued. I just want to call it where the cash flow isn't good enough for us.
Exactly.
And now is one of those times.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm holding on to those properties there, and I think that
your basis is low. So,
yeah, and it's worked out very, very well for me. So and then on top of that, we have a couple of properties that I've held for a long time in California. So yeah, so I'm a happy real estate investor.
Good for you. Good for you. Well, one of the things I wanted to go over was that concept that you were talking. Oh gosh, forgive me. I can't remember. I'm having a senior moment here. See, I can finally say I'm having senior moments.
Are you over the line now?
No, I'm not over the line.
Okay.
The AARP is still a long ways away, I'm glad to say.
Oh, good for you.
But oh gosh, it was something that you just mentioned, and it was the concept of debt, or I don't remember. I'll remember after we finish the talk here today.
Okay.
Of course. Yeah. But what are your thoughts? You know, with now you're in the trucking business now,
right?
And so, do you like what do you do exactly in the trucking?
Yeah.
Business?
So the company that I'm associated with in Southern California. We do local trucking, and a large part of what we do is taking domestic shipping containers to the railroad from all the warehouses that are unloading all these containers that are coming in from China and Vietnam and Japan and Korea and so forth, right? So we do a lot of local trucking, shuttling goods essentially from the harbor to the railroad most of the time. And then we also do consolidation, deconsolidation, some warehousing work as well.
Okay, so you have your industry has a really good barometer on the economy. I mean, you know what the volume of trade looks like, where it's coming from, where it's going to. Are there any thoughts that you have or ideas that you just want to share, and maybe we can just hash them out?
I'm interested. I guess. You know, I mean, what I'm noticing, so we deal with a lot of the large retailers from all over the country, because the goods that we're picking up here, they wind up in Chicago, New Jersey, Atlanta, Dallas, Memphis, wherever, for the large retailers. And it seems to have been a strong retail season. I mean, at least they ordered a lot of stuff. I don't know if it's going to sit in a warehouse on the East Coast somewhere or not, but I can tell you in previous years, we haven't seen this level of activity. This, what we call peak season in shipping, is the season from basically Labor Day up until just after Thanksgiving, leading up to, you know, Black Friday there and all the shopping that gets done. That is the busiest time of the year. And this peak season was, it was unbelievable. It was extremely busy. I haven't seen it as busy for many, many years.
And are most of these goods coming from good old China?
Yeah. Well, especially in California here, you know, our manufacturing zone is called Tijuana. Mm-hmm. I mean, that there are nobody's making anything here, right?
Yeah, right.
What ships out of here is brought in from overseas or just over the border in Mexicali or Tijuana.
And we can thank NAFTA for that, for better or worse.
Exactly, yeah.
In the, what are those called? The maquiladora zones, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember Ross Perot talking about them in the giant sucking sound.
The sucking sound. Well, yeah. he was right about that.
He was right about a lot of things. I wish he would have been elected as nutty as he seemed. I think it would have been the only guy that would have actually shaken things up and made something different.
Well, you know, it's funny. I voted for him the first time, and then I voted for him the second time, and he kind of got a little off kilter there with some of his theories about the Republican Dirty Tricks Committee trying to ruin his daughter's wedding and all that. I'm like, you know what? Even if that was true, I wouldn't say it.
It makes him sound like a paranoid freak, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, very interesting. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about how China is really beginning to slow down, and they are suffering. And, you know, years ago, you used to hear people like Peter Schiff and others like him, the sort of the doom and gloom committee,
right,
talk about this concept of decoupling, how, you know, China will decouple from the United States, meaning that they will create their own middle class and their own consumer base, and they'll have countries around them that trade with them, and they won't need us anymore. And when they don't need us, they'll stop buying our treasury bonds, and our interest rates will skyrocket, and we will be dead. But the exact opposite has happened, oddly. It's really interesting, because they just have not been successful in creating their own middle class.
No.
They're in their own consumer base, right? And the people with money there are bringing it over here.
Exactly. And that's great for this real estate situation we're talking about.
It's great, right? For this everything situation.
Yeah, and the stock market as well. So, yeah, and from what I read about their real estate market, you know, things are, you know, the bubble is finally, at least some air is coming out of it now, right? So it's interesting. I mean, my view on that, you know, Peter Schiff, he's interesting. I've read his books, but You know, I think maybe he's a little bit got too much invested in that gold camp and, and all that type of stuff.
I agree. The gold camp really has gotten it wrong most of the time.
Well, so, you know, they're going to be right. You know, when they say a broken clock's right twice a day.
Yeah, right. But, I love it.
I don't discount entirely. I think that over time, I would not be surprised to see all that come to fruition over time. I don't think it's going to happen, you know, by 2020 or anytime real soon. I mean, we've just heard some statistics recently how China, their GDP is going to surpass ours earlier than what everybody had expected prior to 2020. Some measures of their economy would show that their economy is, in fact, larger than ours right now. So I think that over time, you can kind of see how the trend's going and what the direction is. But nobody wants to piss off their largest customer, and that's us.
Yeah, right.
And you know, it's for better or worse, it is kind of hard to bet against the United States in the long run. I do have some very serious concerns about, you know, this house of cards we have with the, you know, our debt situation and all that. I don't know how that's going to play off. But again, going back to Richard Duncan, I hate to keep quoting him, but this could continue for much longer than what most people would think it could continue. Japan has shown that. I mean, their economy is not like the model economy or anything, but people would certainly rather hold yen than, say, rubles right now. And people thought Russia was the way to go not long ago.
Yeah, I know. I just think that as illogical and unfair as it may be, the United States finds itself in a really impressive place in history. And has benefited from a lot of that. So I you know, as mismanaged as it is in so many ways, I think they can kick this can down the road for decades long.
That's exactly right. You know, and so to prepare your entire life for something that, hey, it could happen. China could make some nutty announcement next year. I kind of doubt it, but it could happen. But I would tend to agree with you. Sometime after 2020, we'll be well into retirement. And who knows? You can't live your whole life in fear.
Yeah, I agree with you. But the interesting thing is about China, and we don't have to, you know, talk about this forever, is that with China, you know, as soon as they start to maybe gain a foothold, say things go really well for China, you know, then they're going to be facing this really huge, ugly demographic problem. And that's the same thing that is really behind what's hurting Japan so much, or at least inhibiting their recovery, is that they just don't have any young people. And China has just far too big a male population, not enough females. And, you know, the one-child policy in 10 years, they're going to be looking at a really tough demographic problem. So if they ever hope to get any real social safety nets there, I just don't know that that's ever going to happen. I hope it goes well for them. I mean, listen, you know, it would be nice if the whole world would just prosper and we'd all live in harmony. It'd be great. But, you know, if you're comparing countries, and like you say, it's really tough to bet against the United States. I just don't know how you can really do it.
Yeah, it really is. But one thing that is very interesting, and I'm sure you've read about this, how China and Russia are getting away from...
They're trading outside of the dollar.
Of the reserve currency of the U.S. So the thing that saved us, I think, the only thing that saved us that can't save a Greece or an Italy, nobody will allow them to indefinitely print their money and accept it. You know, we've got this weird license that allows us to do that. Other people can't do that, or they would be fine too. So I don't think it's that we're so smart or so great or whatever. I think you put it well. We're in this unique spot in history. I think we're allowed to do that. It's kind of a relic of what we used to be. It's not rational or logical. We do get to do that, and it saved our butts. Nobody else gets to do that.
Yeah, I agree. We're just kind of, you know, we worked our way through the Industrial Revolution and we won that game, and now we're just kind of lucky.
So, let's just hope we could catch up. There are some neat things going on right now. I'll throw out a book Have you happened to have read Ray Kurzweil's Abundance?
Oh, well, that's actually Peter Diamantis.
Thank you.
And Steve, they talk about Ray Kurzweil
a lot
in there. But and Stephen Kotler was actually on the show. I love that book. It is amazing.
Yes.
And it leads me to another question. But what were you going to say about that?
Well, I was just saying there is lots of reasons to have hope. And there are with the advances in technology and the speed that things are moving along, people don't even realize, you've got Moore's Law and the technology is increasing every year and a half or so for the same cost. And we're at a point now, initially, we're making exponential gains in what we're capable of doing and what we're going to have access to. And that's going to provide a better standard of living for everybody. And I think that the next 10 years is going to be just an amazing time for us.
I think so, too. For the whole world, the whole
yes.
world's going to benefit from this because, you know, now we're in a position where we have what I like to call the democratization of everything.
Yes.
And, you know, other than the Wall Street cronies and the crony capitalism and the unholy alliance between, you know, government and mega business, I'm not even going to call it big business, it's mega business, okay? Whether it be pharmaceutical companies or the banks or whatever, right? And Elizabeth Warren, you know, I'm definitely not a Democrat, but she gave a great speech that I just posted on my Facebook page. You know, where she just outed all these, you know, criminals with Citibank and, you know, criminals, I'm using that word loosely, obviously, but
right,
know, just
right.
my humble opinion. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, it's just a total scam what's going on, but the technology is just leveling and flattening the earth. I mean, crowdfunding,
yeah.
3D printing, all of
yes.
these things, gene sequencing. You know, last night I watched a TED talk about this. Have you heard of this Kickstarter project for this glowing plant?
Oh, no, I don't know about this.
Oh, it's mind-boggling. Basically, what you can do is you can go to a website now, and you can do this today, and you can design, for better or worse, you know, it is scary, I'll admit. It's, you know, Frankenstein, whatever, okay? But you can design your own life form made of whatever DNA sequence you want. You can put your credit card in, and you basically, this website helps you make the blueprint, and you can order this life form. And the UPS guy will deliver it to you. And someone did that and made a glowing plant. And it's a Kickstarter project. They raised a ton of money. And they hope that ultimately trees will replace streetlights. I mean, just fathom that for a moment. It's incredible.
Oh, my God.
It's unbelievable. Just
no,
Google it.
I'm
you'll
check
find
that
it.
Out.
It's amazing. It's an amazing time to be alive.
Oh, and like you said, so everything is leveling out.
Yeah.
Another great example, I was listening. They're talking about this Sony hacking situation with North Korea.
Right. That's kind of scary.
for those that I haven't found my way onto it, but, you know, there's this dark side of the internet that you can get to.
Yeah.
The dark net. What I heard yesterday was that if you or I wanted to do that, it would cost us about $1,000 to find somebody in Russia or China that will do that for us.
Wow.
To take down a corporation for $1,000. When they were starting to talk about this, I thought the person was going to say $10 million or something like that. $1,000 you
wow.
could do. So
that is mind-boggling. Now it you know, it also might cost you your freedom and your life.
Oh yeah,
but, yeah. Yeah, right. Wow, that's mind-boggling. It really is. It's the power is moving to the people, and it is really, really cool. Now, one thing though, I want to ask you, because you've got so much familiarity with shipping, is, and in the book Abundance, they talk about it, and I've been talking about it for years on my show, but 3D printing, is that going to move a lot of manufacturing back to the U.S.? You know, and it's not for mass production. I understand 3D printing is for more like artisan type production. And there's a great book I read last year when I was in Europe, and it's by Chris Anderson, who's written three great books that I know of. He's the editor of Wired Magazine, and I believe he owns TED now, the conference. And the book is called Makers, and it's all about the 3D printing revolution. And I mean, you know, are those ships not going to be needing to come here quite as much because we're just going to print stuff? I read an article yesterday where we basically emailed a wrench to one of the astronauts at the International Space Station. And what I mean by emailed is emailed the design for the 3D printer they have now. And 4 hours later, he had a wrench in his hand made of matter, made of atoms.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, yeah. It's incredible.
So I've sat in some of these conventions I go to in transportation and logistics, and that's a very real thought. So it's not going to happen real soon, but so you kind of asked two questions. Is 3D printing going to have a big impact on shipping? Yeah, I think it will in time. And the second part is a lot of things are coming back. Again, with the dynamics in China, wages are increasing there. They're calling it nearshoring. So it's not necessarily coming back the United States, although some is, but a lot of it's going back to Mexico. Some stuff, it was in Mexico and those maquiladores moved to China. Now it's coming back.
Wow. Really, it's really quite fascinating what's going on around the world. I mean, what an amazing time to be alive and to just sit back and witness all of this stuff. You know, I mean, certainly we got our share of problems, but, you know, like I say, technology might save us all.
Well, I think so, too. And I think that, you know, for our kids, I really believe that there's never been a better time to be alive in terms of there's never been more opportunity for everybody. I mean, you can be the poorest poor person, maybe not the poorest person, but if you have access to the internet, you've got unlimited education and access to information and role models and so many things.
You got the Khan Academy. It's free. You can learn. You can get 10 PhDs at the Khan Academy for free. It's amazing.
And so that's just tremendous opportunity. And I read where they're predicting within the next 10 years we'll have our first high school billionaire. Right? We already have plenty of kids that dropped out of college to become billionaires, but imagine a high school kid becoming a billionaire.
Not just
because our currency is debased, but because he's creating real value. Yeah. And so it's an amazing time. There's unlimited opportunity out there. Yeah, there's problems, but you know, Jason, you're a little younger than me, but when I was growing up, and you probably heard some of this stuff too, I literally, in my elementary school, my elementary school teacher in third grade told us, you know what? I don't think you guys are going to live to see 30 because there's going to be a nuclear war.
Wow.
Really? I don't know what kind of a maniac teacher.
Today, you would totally get fired for that.
And I think probably justifiably so, because that was a ridiculous thing to say to young kids. But that's what we're worried about. Nuclear annihilation, the Cold War, all this crazy stuff. There's really, you know, we've got these terrorists and, you know, this type of thing. But not massive nuclear annihilation is a very real possibility.
Yeah, that's not too likely.
There's always something to worry about.
There's always something to worry about. But hey, I want to just, before you go, I want to just ask you about real estate for a moment. So have you estimated your returns on your portfolio, or have you been tracking that closely, or do you just like collecting your checks and, you know, you don't think about it too closely? I'm just kind of curious.
I tend to do it each year, you know, as I'm getting the taxes done. I can tell you that over the last 10 years, which is really kind of my real estate investment timeline outside of personal residences and vacation properties that we use for our family and so forth, we've seen a seven-digit, you know, well, I shouldn't call it that because that could imply up to $9 million, but over $1 million in just appreciation. And then the return that we've earned, again, it could have been much greater because of we didn't choose to use a lot of leverage. But I'll tell you this, when I was running my numbers, when we did the when I was doing my analysis in terms of what I was going to buy, routinely, my returns with a moderate amount of leverage, not very much leverage, was 25% to 30%
annually.
Yeah, and that was only assuming a 4% annual appreciation, and I have received much more appreciation than that. So I haven't figured it out in terms of what's my appreciation. Really, the right way to think about this, I think, is what's your appreciation been, what's your cash flow been, and what's your and think of that cash flow in terms of the tax advantages that you're getting. Because here's the other thing, the great advantage of these properties that we bought in foreclosure, you get your statement from the county, and it gives you your assessment. And the vast
majority, your property tax assessment.
Tax assessment. The 80% of the value was in the building, right? So you get depreciation on all of that. And so I've had some very nice sessions with my CPA, because these properties I get to depreciate so much. It's totally legitimate. I'm using the documents that the government's giving me. And it's a very much a tax advantage return. I'm not paying any taxes, obviously, on the appreciation. And on my cash flow, I'm getting a nice depreciation benefit.
Depreciation is the holy grail of tax advantages. It makes income property the most tax favored asset in America by a long shot.
Right.
I mean, I don't know of anything even close, because it's a phantom write off. You don't pay anything to get that.
Yeah.
Your property could go up in value, have positive cash flow.
It does.
And the way the IRS looks at it, you're still losing money, which is good in that sense. You know,
I don't want to ruin that. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. So if you go back to the bond analogy that you gave me all those years ago, it's almost like a municipal bond, right? I mean, you get those wonderful tax advantages. So, you know, the other thing I want to share with you too, Jason, was, you know, the kind of the experience of being a real estate investor as a person that has a full-time job, a family, three kids, and, you know, on the go. You know, some people like, okay, Dave, you're buying these out-of-state properties. First of all, that's nuts. You know, how are you going to ever see your properties? And my answer to that has been, well, I've had rental properties in California, and they are like in the same city I live in, and I very rarely went by there. If you got good property managers and you're kind of managing your property managers, and my management of my property managers and consists of calling them when I see I have a vacancy, or sending them chocolates at Christmas each year. I don't spend a lot of time doing it.
You send them chocolates. Wow, I don't never give anything to my managers. Maybe that's why they like you better.
You know, I'll give you a great example. And this was a property manager that one of your local market specialists turned me on to. And again, this was in Indianapolis. I wasn't happy with my insurance premiums out there. And so your local market specialist is the one that turned me on to the property management company. The property management company turned me on to a insurance group that allowed me to package all these properties and reduce my insurance premiums by 50% in that market with, and I wish I could remember right now, but it was, I checked it out at the time, very high rated insurance companies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they can take very good care of you. I want them to like me more than the other landlord that they have when they have one tenant and two houses. They're going to decide which stuff, you know, where they're going
to
put the tenant.
You right? Want them to think maybe we'll get some chocolates from
there. Yeah, exactly. Let me get that chocolate benefit.
Yeah.
So, you know, I spend very little time on this because I do use property managers. I've gone the other route and tried to manage them myself.
Oh,
and
you did self-management from a distance, because I do both, and I'm just shocked that I could even do that. How was your experience? Sounds like you weren't keen on it.
I wasn't. Well, I tried to be a property manager here on the properties in California, and what happened is when it started to go south, I wasn't going by the properties enough. And then when it started to go south, quite honestly, I didn't quite know what to do as far as this whole taking people to court stuff and all that.
Tell us what happened. What do you mean? Did you have an eviction?
Yeah, I had an eviction.
Okay.
And so what happened is at that point in time, I just found a property manager. I said, hey, get me out of this mess, and then you can manage these properties from now on. And that's what we did. And it's worked out great. I think these people earn their 7 or 8% or whatever it is that you're paying them. For me, now, maybe if I was a retired guy and I like doing that stuff, fine. So the work, I think, with getting these investment properties was really in deciding which ones you were going to buy and doing your due diligence in that regard. Certainly, you were a big help. Your team was a big help in helping me to locate the appropriate markets that had the good returns in certain areas within those markets and all that. But even after that, you got to decide, okay, which house are you going to buy, right? And but I actually really enjoy that process. And again, with all this technology we have, you can drive down the street. You can look in your neighbor's backyard.
You can do it in Google Maps. You can drive down the street. Yeah.
Oh, I do. I did it on every single one of them. And one of the earlier podcasts I talked to, I would look at the schools What's the whole situation with the schools?
Dave, I forgot. You are the guy that created or it discovered the free lunch metric.
You remember that?
Yes, I remember naming it that. It was such a good idea. You feel free to tell the listeners. It's on the old podcast, which I'm sure is still posted. You can find it at jasonhartman.com and or on maybe on iTunes. I don't know. Those old ones on iTunes, I think they drop off after a while. I got to check that. But it's on our website, I'm sure. And
right.
It's still posted. But that was a great idea that you did. Tell the listeners about that.
Yeah, so really what that, you know, everyone has their own view on the types of properties they want to invest in. And you know what? There's a need for Section 8 housing. There's a need for penthouses. And there's a need for solid single-family residences, which is what I was looking for. And I didn't really want any trouble. So what I looked at was, what was the percentage of children in the local school that qualified for free lunch? And so if it was below 50%, it was an area that I was comfortable with. Now, the houses that we purchased, I always wanted to think of it as, you know what, I would live there, or my kids, I would be totally comfortable and happy with them living there. And I'm very proud of our real estate portfolio. I think they're very nice properties, and I'm proud to own them, and I think we provide a very nice housing arrangement for people. So that kind of just was one of those tests for me, a litmus test. If less than 50% of the kids in the local school get free lunch, I was happy with it. I consider it to be a reasonably solid economic area.
That's a good metric. So like you said, there's an investor and a property type for everybody.
Yeah.
And you like the A properties, kind of the nicer properties.
Right.
And we have those. We have B properties and we have C properties.
Right.
Honestly, the C properties, they have the great numbers, but the tenants are just more flaky. They're just more difficult to deal with. So the thing I say about C landlords is it's going to require probably a little more of your attention, and it's going to require you to manage your emotional state better because you're just going to have more trials with C type properties, you know?
Yeah.
And we've got them all. We used to only do A and B type properties. We got into the C stuff because just a lot of our clients wanted it.
Right.
So, you know, they can take their pick and you know, you've got your pick and your model and it works for you. So that's awesome. I love
it. Yeah. So that's worked well for me. But, you know, with the, you know, there were some of these properties that I bought that I'd never seen them because they were out of state. I may have driven through the general area and I didn't go to see them for a couple of years after the fact. I mean, that happened. And I would talk to people about that and they'd say, you know, how can you do that? You know, how can you just trust that everything's okay? Well, I didn't just trust. I did my research. I can walk through the house virtually. I can walk through the neighborhood virtually. I know everything about the schools. I know everything about the crime report in the area. I can pull all, and I did pull all that information up. What I would ask them, though, is what about these companies that you're investing in your mutual funds and that you're buying? Do you know what's going on? Do you sit at the board of directors meeting? Do you know how, if they're about to get sued or they're in the middle of a lawsuit or they're considering being bought or they're going to buy something or there's some legal problem?
Or the CEO just is about to get nailed for some huge sexual harassment case, or, you know, you don't know this stuff.
Yeah. I know more virtually on my fundamentals of the investment on this real estate if I never, ever go there. People who goes, if they own Apple stock, they've been to Cupertino and visited with the man. They don't do that, but they'll have no problem putting $50,000-$100,000 in Apple stock.
I know. It's
and weird. And so people really need to understand, you know, how they're thinking about things. And everyone hears the nightmare land, you know, tenant stories.
Like,
and all
the, like the one story, right, that everybody's had
that
discouraged them, you know?
Yeah. But it's a, you know, I don't know my tenants. They don't know me. I've got great property managers. I spend, it's really just the accounting stuff. You know, I spend an hour a month on it and it's not a big deal. And it's just an investment I've been very happy with.
An hour a month for how many properties, by the way?
13 rental properties.
So 13 rental properties only takes you an hour a month. See, I tell people, and I know this is high, but occasionally if there's like a problem property, it could suck up a little more time. So I just tell people, assume 1 hour per property per month. So if you've got 13, I'd say 13 hours a month. But you only spend an hour a month for all 13 properties, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I've had good fortune, I guess. I mean, I just don't have big problems with my tenants. I mean, you know, you've got the occasional dishwasher, air conditioner. It's an email in the middle of other stuff I'm doing. I say, yeah, do that. No, get another quote. It doesn't take much time. Once you've got them established and you've got the property manager taking care of it, I don't see how it could take me 13 hours a month.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. I think, you know, as humans, I mean, and certainly I'm sure we all do this. I know I do it. I'm sure you've done it at times, and everybody listening probably has too. We all kind of get in our own way, and we sometimes micromanage stuff, or, you know, we get upset about something, and then we just get all freaked out about it, and, you know, and it sort of just occupies our emotions, and we go dump on other people. Not exactly a good quality, but, you know, we all have to admit we've all done it.
Well, you know, I've been more than willing to pay, whether it be property managers or in the initial stage, you buy these properties that aren't new properties and need a little bit of rehab. Now, you know, my brother-in-law, who is a client of yours, I referred him to you, he kind of had a different approach. He took vacation time. He flew down there. He helped rehab the properties. He's more
He's a hands-on guy.
Yeah, a little more handy type guy. I didn't want any kind of experience like that, right?
Yeah, me neither. I don't like that. Yeah, we don't do that stuff.
You know, he slept in the property when
Oh my gosh. He's like my mom. My mom's like that. Yeah.
Working on it and painting it and stuff. But he likes that. And so God bless him. That's what he likes to do, and that's what he should do then. But I consider that to be like some type of torture, and I don't want to do that.
That's called work, and I don't like work like that.
Well, to me, it's all about passive income, and so we've developed that. And that's provided some nice benefits from paying down some of these. And not only that, but we've used the proceeds to invest in another business, which is actually doing quite well right now and generating more passive income. So it's just been really good all the way around.
Good for you. That's awesome. Well, so just to recap, and I'm keeping you along here, but this has just been a great conversation. So thank you so much for coming on the show. But you've made over $1 million in appreciation. And how many years? When did you start? Did you start in 2009?
So that would be starting in 2004.
If 2004. Okay. Yeah. See that Arizona, I think it's, you know, it's hybrid, but you got to be careful you don't give it back. Well, you bought early enough that you'll be okay.
But if
someone were to buy today or in 2006 in Arizona, they could eat it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right.
And same with California, too.
You know. You know what? And I think you say there's no such thing as a bad, you know, there's all these different markets all over the country, right? And everyone rises and falls, and that's the great service that you and your team provide, right? Which market makes sense to be in right now based on what your goals are, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we do. That's what we watch for people. And, you know, the comparison, though, is those indie properties gave you much better cash flow than the California and even the Arizona properties.
Yeah, right. They absolutely. Those are going to be hard to beat from a cash flow perspective. And that's really what I was after. And I've been very pleased with the stability of the tenant base, the economy there. And you know what? Because we did buy at the time that we bought, we've gotten, you know, much greater appreciation than one would expect normally to get in Indianapolis. I think you could still buy an Indy and do real well from a cash flow standpoint.
Oh, yeah. No, Indy's still good. The prices are definitely higher than they used to be, but you can still make your cash flow numbers there. And that's why it's kind of our perennial market. I mean, we've got other markets that are great too, but you know, Indy's been a very good market for us. I've personally made a lot of money in Indy myself buying properties there, so I love it. It's good stuff. Well, Dave, that's a very inspiring story, and thank you so much for sharing it with our listeners and coming back on the show again. I really appreciate it, and it was just great talking to you.
All right, my pleasure, Jason.
Here's your chance to catch up on all of those Creating Wealth shows that you've missed. There's a 3-book set with shows 1 through 60, all digital download. You save $94 by buying this 3-book set. Go ahead and get these advanced strategies for wealth creation. For more details, go to jasonhartman.com. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.